In a world where screens are taking over and phones are no longer for making calls, one famous voice from the land of Hollywood has spoken up and written a book. Parenting for the Digital Age. More than just an author, Bill Ratner is a storyteller, educator, voice actor, and father of two children. He's coming to town to entertain and enlighten us with a show called Media Madness. Coming soon to the Arrowhead Center for the Arts. Well, before the show, we'd like to know, who is Bill Ratner? Here to tell us a tale or two, Mr. Bill Ratner. Welcome to the Roadhouse.
I love that. That makes me feel really important, Dave. Who is Bill Ratner?
Well,
that's probably the first thing that my mother said when I was born.
Who is Bill Ratner? I've had this a bit of a joke of an opening question that just puts it out there. Who are you? but I didn't want to put you on the spot.
And, well, it's an existential question, and frankly, at my age, I'm actually not sure.
Well,
I got a phone call from Jerry Lilja, who works with North Shore Healthcare Foundation, and said, I got a hold of your book, and we want you to come to Grand Marais. And I said, goodness gracious, how'd you get a hold of my book? You're way north of Duluth. And I had written Parenting for the Digital Age, The Truth Behind Media's Effect on Children and What to Do About It, in 2014, and went to the American Library Association with it and got into a bunch of libraries, and maybe that's how it fell into Jerry's hands. But this has blown up into something bigger than Coachella and the Academy Awards, Dave.
Well,
I don't know what to do.
Tonight, we'd like to focus on the man behind the voice, behind the book, and how you got your start down the Yellow Brick Road of Fame.
Well, you know, I was very lucky. My dad was an advertising guy. We lived in first in Des Moines, where he was managing editor of Better Homes and Gardens, and then got bought up by the advertising business, as most editors of national magazines did back in the 50s. And we moved to South Minneapolis, and my dad worked for Campbell Methuen Advertising, that was a big outfit. It was the biggest ad agency west of the Mississippi at the time. And by the time I got to high school, I was told by my family, you're going to work for a living. So I worked as an errand boy from age 14 for John Forney Advertising, Campbell Methuen Advertising. And they had about 250 employees in the North Star Center on Marquette Avenue and 7th Street in downtown Minneapolis. And as an errand boy, I got to know everybody. And I worked down in the sub-basement, printing things up and doing all and sorting mail. What I did on the sly that was probably violating federal guidelines was I would steam open applicants' resumes and look at them and say, who is this guy from Michigan State University? What does he think he can do coming to Minneapolis working for Campbell Methuen? And then I'd put it back in the envelope and distribute it to the right person. And I would sneak into the seminars that were being given by the account executives on how we sell the Pillsbury Doughboy to America without making people feel silly, pretending that they're the Pillsbury Doughboy going. And, my dad was a good guy, and he brought me to work on Bring Your Kid to Work Day. And but from age 14, I had a professional view, a bird's eye view of how a television commercial was made, how a radio commercial was made, why it was made, why they hired people from the Minneapolis Symphony Orchestra to play on a Frito-Lay commercial. And it was really a fun job because advertising people are creative and kooky and things move fast. And I ended up going to school as a journalism major. My crossroads was in the summer when I turned 18 and graduated Washburn High School. The paste-up boy who had actually sold a couple of beer six-pack designs to the ad agency said, this is a great job. I'm moving on. You should take my job. Don't go to college. And I thought, I'm going to college and be an educated person. But by that time, I had already begun working in radio as a little kid, first ham radio, amateur radio, and then friends and I formed the Brotherhood of Radio Stations, Dave.
Oh, yeah.
Don't know if you were ever a charter member. I don't think we went national. I think it was limited to the four of us in South Minneapolis. You know.
That seemed to be a big door opener for you, though. You know, in the book, you tell a great story about getting your first big job at KISS 99 out in San Fran, was it?
And yeah, the suburbs of San Francisco. I've been in Walnut Creek, California.
Had it not been for that being the director of your station back home, you wouldn't have got that break.
Well, I don't want to tell a prospective job applicants in the communication business to lie. However, when I was interviewed for the job as midday announcer, it would be my first radio job, and I was already 30 years old. I was working in the sales department on the telephone selling these $50 advertising packages to beauty parlors and gas stations way out in the suburbs of San Francisco. And so I went in and I sat down with the general manager, and he said, well, you know, you're doing a good job carting up these spots on the air. Why do you want to be a radio announcer? And I said, well, I was president and general manager of WCLO radio station in Minneapolis, and program director. And, you know, it was a small outfit. We had a small transmitter, and this was all true. What I didn't tell him was I was 12 years old at the time. And he gave me the job, gave me a raise from $155 to $165 a week.
Oh, yeah. And that was real money, right? You went out and leased a foreign sports car and
big
Italian
time.
Suits. And
the night before, my first air shift from 10 a.m. to 12 to 2 in the afternoon, playing easy listening music, which means Percy Faith cover tunes of Beatles songs, basically. I had a nightmare. I dreamed that I was in the studio trying to put a cartridge into the cartridge machine to play a commercial, and the cartridge was as big as a gas oven. And it was based on the fact that I knew absolutely nothing about how to run a radio station, and that was the truth. But that was the beginning, and I ended up going to film school at City College of San Francisco, taking some classes, and a couple of teachers hired me to do voiceovers, and so that was these were my humble beginnings, Dave.
Well, and I think a lot of it had to do with meeting Betty Crocker when you were 12 years old. Could you tell us a little bit about that party?
You know, my dad, being an advertising executive, threw parties at his house for people he worked with and for clients and so on, and he always hired me and my brother, and to take coats and serve hors d'oeuvres and so on. And one night he comes up to my room and says, I got a big star for you to meet, son, big star. Come on down. And I put my shoes back on and went downstairs. And here was this really lovely middle-aged blonde lady. And he said, this is Betty Crocker. And I looked at her, and she looked a little bit like the woman on the cake mix box. But at the time, in the late 50s, the graphic image of the woman called Betty Crocker was an actual photographic composite of over 150 American women created by commercial artists at the ad agency that had the Betty Crocker account, saying, we want her to look like the American woman. And this is what they came up with. They didn't have Photoshop at the time, but they would have used it if they had. And this was the woman who played Betty Crocker on radio and on TV in the live action commercials. And I was really taken aback. I mean, I didn't even know what he meant. What do you mean, play her on TV? I mean, the same way that I played G.I. Joe with action figures. It was kind of fun, and she was very elegant and had lots of jewelry and expensive pearls on. It was very nice. Nice to meet you, Billy. And many, many years later, I was grown up, and I was living in Hollywood, and I had been hired to do some Bank of America radio commercials. And I walk into the studio, and the engineer hands me the advertising copy, and the director's there, and, okay, stand at the mics, please. And there's an older woman standing there, and she said my name a couple of times. She said, I think I worked with your father. And suddenly, I go roaring back into my childhood, and this was Betty Crocker. And I said, wait a minute. I met you at my house, and when my father said, big star, big star. So this, for me, and by that time, my father had passed on, and so it was a wonderful memory at the kind of beginning of my professional freelance voiceover career to be able to work with the same woman I had met when I was 12 years old, and who by this time was probably in her late 50s and was working as a staff announcer at the ABC affiliate in Los Angeles. So she had continued her career as a communications broadcast professional. But it was a very special moment for me that connected me with my childhood and those fond and productive memories, and sort of spurred me on emotionally and otherwise to continue my career as a voiceover guy.
We are on the Roadhouse with Bill Ratner. He's coming to town. He's got a new, pretty recent book out, Parenting for the Digital Age, and it's the truth behind media's effect on children and what to do about it. Bill, you've been in the advertising media all your life. You seem to be immersed in this. How has your attitude changed in and around advertising? Have you turned down deals to pitch? Do you have ethics and morals when it comes to advertising?
I have turned down deals to pitch. I have friends who work in Washington, D.C. as voiceover people, and one guy who was active in my union, the Screen Actors Guild, American Federation of TV Radio Artists, I assumed that he was probably a Democrat because he was a union activist. And I said, you work is pretty much for Democrats in D.C.? He said, no, I work for everybody. And I was really taken aback because I think politics are important, and I think who's nominated for the major parties and who ends up being elected to office in this country from local to national is very important. And I was taken aback that he and many others who work for political consultancy firms, lending their voices to radio and TV campaigns for political campaigns and candidates, if they live in Washington, D.C., many of them work for any party that wants to pay their freight. I frankly am glad that I'm not faced with that kind of moral decision, because I think it is a moral decision. And I have made moral decisions. There are outfits that I'm not interested in working for and products that I'm not interested in selling. But I'm not a socialist or a communist, and we live in a capitalist society, and advertising is one of the drivers of consumerism and selling products. But to answer your question, the thing that changed me and turned me around a bit was having children. I had gotten cast as the voice of Flint in the cartoon G.I. Joe that came from the Hasbro character G.I. Joe, who was a big action figure in the 60s and then into the 70s and was a comic book, and then later became the cartoon show, which had a long, long life in syndication. And the character of Flint was actually brought back onto an episode of Family Guy, an episode of Robot Chicken on the Cartoon Channel, and an episode of Community on NBC TV when it was running. And when I had little kids, I would very proudly bring home, you know, VHS copies and DVDs of things that I was doing. And, hey, guys, look what Daddy's on today. Until I realized that these kids of mine suddenly became better at operating the DVR and the smart TV than my wife and I were, and that they were spending an inordinate amount of time watching and didn't much care what they watched. I mean, of course, they would rather watch children's programming than soap operas, but it got out of hand. And then with the advent of the laptop computer and instant messaging and Facebook and Twitter and all of it, these little girls and their friends, who we often would babysit for in the neighborhood, were hooked on digital media. And my wife had had an experience with her father when she was a little girl in the 50s, where both my wife's and her older sister's grades were going down in school because they were watching the brand new television set way too much. And he tried all kinds of logic and conversations and, come on, guys, turn off the TV. Finally, he just reached into the back of that old RCA set. This is back in the late 50s, and pulled out the vacuum tubes and hid them. Daddy, the TV set doesn't work. Oh, gosh, girls, I'm so sorry, my father-in-law said to his daughters when they were young. We'll have to have the TV man come and repair it. Well, the TV man never showed up. A repair was never made. As his sister-in-law went on to become a PhD and taught at Cleveland State. My wife went on to get her master's in education, and they did fine. I think in no small part because their dad, my father-in-law, was brave enough to pull the tubes from the back of the set. Well, what do you do today? My book, Parenting for the Digital Age, is full of all kinds of interviews I did with parents and teachers. And I asked parents point blank, what do you do? What did you do when your kid was little? What do you do now with your kids to deal with the onslaught of digital media? You give a kid an iPhone or an iPad at age 2 or 3, and it looks awfully cute, and they can play the games, and they end up speaking to no one. Not their friends, not their grandma and grandpa. You're sitting with your child on a Saturday morning and having breakfast, and that kid sneaks out of their chair and grabs the iPad and goes into their bedroom, and they're hypnotized. And is that a bad thing? It's not a bad thing in and of itself, but it's not a great thing if it happens day in and day out. And it's a question of how much. Most families came up with the solution of, you have to sit down with your kids and negotiate. It is a negotiation. If you have a 3-year-old, that's one thing. They're going to scream and yell if they can't have the iPad. If you have a 13-year-old, that's a whole other thing. And so you have to bring your kids into the discussion. What should we do in our house? Do you guys know any kids at school who are so hooked on games and their iPads they don't talk to anybody? Oh, yeah, Dad. Billy Barson, boy, he used to be friendly and everything. Now he just goes in his basement and blah, blah, blah. Well, we don't want that in our house, do we? No, we don't, Mom. Well, what do we do? And that's the kind of conversation that has to happen with your children, whether you're a single parent or both parents are there and available to their kids. So because of these conversations that I had with parents and because of the experience of watching my kids sort of get lost in their smartphones and their smart TVs and so on, I decided to do some research and ended up being asked to write this book by a company called Familius Publishing in Sanger, California. Writes books for the family, or publishes books for the family. I formed a program in the Los Angeles Unified School District called TV Cartoon Scandals Media Awareness for Children. And I still have a smartphone. I'm delighted to have it. And my daughters have smartphones and so on. But I think because I spent a lot of time reading to them as kids, and I limited the amount of time they could spend playing games on their phones and their pads and watching TV, I think they're better for it. That's my opinion, and I'm sticking to it.
Yeah, well, it's a great book, Bill. You know, I got two sons myself. They're in that age group right now. We're really struggling with this. And I found it to be the perfect weekend workshop for advertising, the media, and parenting, three of my favorite pastimes. You know, how enjoyable was the creative process for the book? You are, you know, naturally a creative person. Did you have any difficulty putting your thoughts to words?
I did. I went back to college in my 40s and got a degree in creative writing, and I published some short stories and personal essays, and that was a lot of fun. And, you know, it's time consuming, but it's fun and creative. And then The Moth Storytelling. I don't know if you're familiar with The Moth Radio Hour, put out by National Public Radio.
Sure.
Where, you know, true stories told in front of a live audience without notes. There's a big movement on radio these days, true storytelling, personal storytelling. It's a lot of fun. And themoth.org is a really fun website to visit and to see if there's a storytelling coming to your town. Well, there are three venues in the Los Angeles area. And in 2008, I started going just as an audience member to see, what is this live storytelling taking place in a bar or a nightclub or a coffee house once a month in the evening? And the venues were all packed with 20 and 30 somethings. And you go on the website and find out the theme for the evening and come up and tell a story based on that. And some people prepare, some people write them down and memorize them. Some people just sort of get up and improvise. And I started doing it. I thought, gee, this looks fun. And I heard some great, fun stories, some sad, some fascinating, some educational, and all of them kind of riveting. And I started writing these things myself and getting up and telling stories. And then ended up being hired to go to some storytelling conferences. And that's where I was approached by the woman whose husband and she had started Familius Publishing. And she said, I really enjoyed your talk about media awareness for kids. Would you be interested in writing a book about it? And I said, why do you ask? She said, we're just starting a publishing company. And I had really, Dave, only written short stories and personal essays that were anywhere from 750 to 1500 words. That's 3 to 5 pages, a typed double space page. And so I got halfway through this Parenting for the Digital Age. I took these nice people up on their offer from Familias and said, oh, you bet. What fun. This is what I'm interested in. And I'll interview my friends and I'll tell stories about working in advertising as a kid and being cast as a cartoon voice and trying to figure out what to do with our kids in digital media. And I got about 85 pages in and I didn't have any more in me. I didn't have any more to say. So I sent the manuscript in, I think in March of 2014. The publisher wrote back a very nice note and said, you know, we really like what you're doing, but we can't publish an 85-page book. And they didn't want 600 pages. They wanted about 150, 160 pages. So I was really knocked back on my heels. I thought, what do I do? So I started doing more research and started talking to more people and started asking more detailed questions of teachers and educational psychologists and media pundits and broadcasters. And fortunately was able to, happened upon interesting research and really interesting answers from parents and teachers as to how, what do they do when kids bring their cell phones home and can't put them down? What do teachers do when kids bring their cell phones into class and can't put them down or put them in the desk or turn them off and stick them in the backpack? And so the book just grew and grew and grew to the proper length and fortunately got published. And I went on a book tour and I worked for a bunch of TV stations around the country as the voice tonight at 5, then plus news at 11. That's what I do for a living. So I called up a bunch of these TV stations and I said, hey guys, I've been your voice for 10 years. Why don't you put me on your morning show? I've written a book about how to tell people not to watch TV. And some of them were, oh, wait a minute. This is no good. Then I changed my pitch a little bit and ended up on a bunch of TV stations, had a great time and a bunch of radio interviews and print and so on, and had to do a lot of it myself. And had a little bit of help from the publisher and publicists, but writers these days, even celebrity writers, of course, which I am not, do a lot themselves. You know, they have Twitter pages and Facebook pages and they may or may not have assistants, and many of them get on their own and tweet out to their followers and so on. So I kind of aped and imitated some of that behavior, but it's been a fun ride, and it's allowed me to continue to have the conversation with friends and colleagues such as yourself about what do you do with kids in digital media.
Well, we'll be at your show on Tuesday, Bill, and I really appreciate you making time for us in great white north Minnesota, way, way far from Hollywood. I could talk to you all night, Bill, but I got to wrap this up. I did just want to ask you one last fun question, and that is, what's some good or a good inside joke that you Hollywood voice actors have?
Oh, my. How many voiceover actors does it take to screw in a light bulb? It takes 15. One to screw in the light bulb. 14 to sit around saying, well, have fun with it. Relax. Accent certain words.
That's right. Yeah. Agents and engineers and publicists. Yeah, Well, you're the man, Bill. Bill Ratner, author of Parenting for the Digital Age, voice of Flint. And, you know, of course, I was rushing home to see G.I. Joe in 1983. I'm 42 years old.
you're in the demographic.
It worked. I've got a closet full of toys. Friend. You've done it, Bill. You've got us hooked. Right, and we really appreciate you swinging the pendulum over to the educational side of things.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate it. And I'll see you next week.